the name of the values that keep you alive, do not let your vision of man be distorted by the ugly, the cowardly, the mindless, and those who have never achieved his title. Do not lose your knowledge that man's proper estate is an upright posture, an intransigent mind, and a step that travels unlimited roads. Do not let your fire go out, sparked by replacing the spark in the hope the swamps of the approximate are not quite, the not yet, the not at all. The world you desired can be won. It exists. It is real. It is possible. It's yours.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Crypto Economy Podcast. I'm here with Will. Will, thanks for being here.
Yeah, of course. Anytime.
So today we're going to be going into sort of a crash course on currency. So the history of money. The history of certain economic systems. We'll go back to ancient history, talk about how, you know, the Romans, the Mesopotamians, the Egyptians, all these different groups thought about money, thought about economics, and how we can factor that into what we know today. So a lot of times I think we get stuck into this sort of perception that what we know is what has to be. So just because we've known paper money our whole lives, it doesn't mean that that necessarily has to be the case going forward. We've seen that, you know, with credit cards, you know, only about $1.4 trillion in banknotes is actually ever circulating in the U.S. And, you know, the market cap of crypto is soon going to be up there. So it's interesting to see how ancient cultures have looked at some of these problems, what the major problems different governments have had when talking about economics and using their own currencies, what those have been. So I think we can learn a lot from the past. I think American school systems in particular don't do a great job at history, and often we forget. So sometimes it's good to be reminded.
It's also, yeah, it's also really beneficial to be knowledgeable about the not only the currency systems, but the systems that undergird them, the economic systems, because there's kind of a dichotomy right now between kind of like the way that transactions are facilitated via currency and the actual underlying systems. And people think that just because technology is progressing on the currency side, that automatically implies that the systems beneath them are evolving as well, when they're actually not. So the only way to fix that is by having a good, a deep understanding.
Yeah, absolutely. So to do that, we're first going to go all the way out to this island in the Pacific Ocean called Yap. There was no silver or gold on Yap, so they didn't have some of the typical means of exchange that other cultures had used. But what they did have is these giant limestone deposits, and these were on an island that was hundreds of miles away. So they carved this limestone into these huge stone discs. They brought them back to their island on these bamboo boats, and they would use them for things like dowries and big purchases. And a lot of archaeologists and historians have looked at this as sort of the quintessential case for what money is, what it has to be, some of the earliest forms of money. And they think it's interesting that the society used these giant stones in the way they did. So the way they used them is, you know, they would have them anywhere on the island, really. So it could be in the center of the village, and everyone sort of knew who owned what stones. You know, there weren't that many people, so they had an actual, a database or a record of who owned what at any given time. It didn't matter if you actually had the stone. And interestingly enough, in one case, one of the stones actually sunk to the bottom of the ocean. And the story goes that he was still able to use that to conduct business. So really, you know, money is only as valuable as our belief in its value, or any means of exchange for that matter. So, you know, it doesn't matter what it is. All that matters is everyone else believes that it can be used for something specific.
That's really interesting. So because of the fact that everybody knew that it was underwater meant it was still valid because it couldn't be stolen. It was just sitting there. Everybody knew that it was still attributed to him.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a public ledger.
Yeah, that's literally what it was. You know, it's not that complicated. But, you know, that's a really interesting case. So, I mean, this is, you know, 3000 BC, as, you know, the first time we've recorded people. These are the people of Uruk using pictographic tablets and clay to record economic transactions. And Mesopotamia soon after started using some of these to model their economic systems. So they had sort of, it was a hybrid of, you know, stones and records, with some, you know, harder forms of currencies. There was, you know, following Mesopotamia, so the major ones we'll go over: Mesopotamia, Greece, some into the Romans, some into the UK, and then into the US. So the Athenian financial system was a little different than Mesopotamia, because they didn't necessarily, they didn't loan out as much. So emergency loans still happened, but most of the financial institutions and the activities were done to foster maritime trade. So when you try to figure out, you know, what differentiated a seafaring nation that was, you know, hell-bent on creating their own dynasty, you know, someone like Europe, or sorry, not Europe, but England. The major differences, it seems to be, is their focus on lending and their company structure. So by giving people the tools to create larger ventures, by loaning out money to explorers, they created an industry around you know, exploration, which is exactly what happened. So before that, there was the shift from stones and clay to mostly coins. The nice thing about gold and silver is there was a naturally limited supply, so they couldn't just print money like the US government can or other governments. You know, you can only have so much gold and silver as you have to mine. So, you know, around 1000 BC, we first saw bronze and copper appearing in China. And these are some of the earliest metal coins. Things like metal tool money were used, so like knives and spades. Those were used a lot for bartering within China. 600 BC is actually when the first known currency was created, and that was King Alaeetes in Lydia, which is now a part of Turkey. So there are some cryptos. I think there's Lydia coin or Lydian coin. I think that's a an homage to the first coin developed back then, and it features this roaring lion, which was, you know, sort of symbolic of the time. In 806 AD, that was when the first banknotes started to appear, and those were in China. They had 500 years of paper money from the 9th to the 15th century. So China has been a long-time innovator of these methods of transacting, and it's interesting to notice that China, you know, initially was very much on board with cryptocurrencies. I think at the end of the day, they're going to continue to be going forward. If they really want to move people off off the dollar and more towards China, one of the best things they can do is bring people together under a currency that isn't the dollar. So I think it's going to be a lot easier for them to do that than to try and get everyone to move more towards, you know, China's currency and payment
Oh yeah,
systems.
I mean they have a great population for adoption because all the party can just decide what to do and then you've got 1 billion people or 1.5 billion people that'll be forced to adopt it. So that's a good way to tech steamroll through the world.
They are a great testing ground, and I mean, you've seen that with a lot of the stuff that they've been putting out there. But in a lot of ways, you know, I think that's going to make them much more effective going forward, because we're going to have more and more of these projects that require a large team of people working together on a continual basis. And you know, in the US, we can get teams of, you know, 20, 30 guys together. You can have these giant companies, but I don't think everyone is motivated in the same way. I don't think it's as easy to get large groups of people in a homogeneous population where you can, you know, manipulate the incentive structures through government programs, which is essentially what their, you know, social credit system is built to do, to incentivize whatever behavior the party wants. And so, you know, I think going forward, that's going to be important.
Oh yeah,
But
sure. I mean, it could be a tool and a weapon because I think weren't they single-handedly responsible for that Bitcoin crash from 17,000 back down to 8? Or not single-handedly, but
Well,
they played a big role. Yeah.
yeah. So a lot of the miners decided they were going to wait until a certain threshold was hit. I think it was 20K they were trying for, or at least I think it was 25K initially. They realized they weren't going to quite get there. So right around 20K, all the miners started liquidating. And that was about the same time they were selling off all of their inventory. So,
Interesting. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, so go ahead and return to what you're saying.
yeah, sure. So, more broadly, worldwide, as far as economics goes, in ancient Greek, I thought this was interesting. The word for interest, tokos, actually refers to the offspring of cattle. So the Latin term picus or flock, the root word is penutiary. The Egyptian word for interest, like the Sumerian word, is ms, which means to give birth. So all these ideas about interest were initially referencing offspring from cattle. So you would give someone, your sheep or your livestock to care for a year, and in exchange you would get, whatever the offspring was as payment. So you would have these interesting systems that were all based on, the main good at the time, which was livestock, food, and so that was sort of the evolution of the term.
Interesting indeed. Yeah, that's kind of still the case, except a lot more literal now.
Exactly. But people have sort of taken this idea to heart that if you borrow something, you need to give back more. There needs to be some sort of payment for doing so. So when you look into the history, Mesopotamia is very often brought up as one of the most important places for the start of a lot of economic reformations. There are a few stories that I wanted to just sort of read off for you. So in 1796, there was a guy named Dumazi Gabil and his partner Shumi Abia, 1796 BC. So this is, 4,000 years ago. And these guys borrowed 500 grams of silver from a businessman and promised to return 297.3 grams of his share of 250 grams after 5 years. So in the way that the Mesopotamians calculated interest, this was about a 3.78% annual rate. And the loan term was 5 years. So, this is one of the first records we have of a loan being made and successfully paid back, and we have an idea of the interest rates they were charging. And it's interesting because if you look at a mortgage, you're probably going to pay about 3.78%. It's crazy that 4,000 years ago we were using almost the same interest rates, which I think is really interesting. And although a mortgage is more like 30 years as opposed to five, we're going to get into how loan terms have changed over time a little bit.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, I actually do follow kind of pretty closely the lifespan of humanity as it increases. I mean, I'm sure we're kind of extended past a little bit now, just because of the overall wealth of the world. But yeah, it's really interesting to look back in Mesopotamia. They really are the cradle of civilization for not just economics, but a lot of other things as well, many categories. So yeah, continue.
And so, as far as the effects of their lending system on their economy, they found that the crop yields for the farmers that were in debt were actually much higher than the ones from farmers without debt. So, debt was actually a motivator for people. It forces you to work because you, well, at that time, you would face slavery essentially if you didn't pay debt. So you would pledge your liberty as collateral for your loan at that time, and this is something that happened all throughout history. And I think it's interesting to see how that has changed now, where the repercussions for being in debt are a little different. In some ways, I think it's good. In some, it's bad though. So back then, yeah, you might go to a debtor's prison for a couple years, but at the end of the day, you can, once you're out, you can go to some other part of the world where your credit score isn't following you and start it up again. Here, we don't have that luxury here and now because these things follow us wherever we go.
Yeah, and also debtor's prison now specifically forbade by the Constitution. You can't have debtor's prisons in America, so yeah, you kind of get off there a bit.
It's weird that we have this system where you can borrow all this money and then just go bankrupt and never pay it back. There are penalties in place, but there are people, like Trump, who know how to work the system to their advantage, and it leaves everyone else who doesn't understand how to use it at a fairly big disadvantage. So, as far as forgiving debts in the past, so in 1788 BC in Mesopotamia, there was this financial catastrophe. The king ended up issuing a royal edict declaring all the loans null and void. So all the debtors were happy, and all the creditors were freaked out because the balances on their lenders' accounts had been wiped out. And there were actually a number of parties who sued the king after this happened, and they weren't very successful. But it's interesting to see how there's kind of a constant struggle between the king and the lower income peasant class, and then you have the wealthier merchants and the wealthier lenders who, by way of lending, ended up getting exceedingly wealthy. So these people, the inequality increased significantly once you introduced lending. And these guys started to consolidate power. They started to have more of a say in government. And that was a big change. But at the same time, the king has to keep, most of his constituents happy. And if most of them are, suffering from debt, it makes sense to wipe it out every once in a while. And this was something that seemed to happen fairly frequently going forward after that. So these kings would sporadically just clear the debt of anyone who had a loan out. And the problem was then all of the lenders stopped giving out long-term loans. So they didn't want to risk to take that risk for too long of a period of time. And they would increase interest rates as a result because the degree of risk would increase. So the risk that they would never get their money back, would increase significantly.
And
And
the
so
economy
everyone,
slows down, I imagine, right?
yeah, exactly. You have less people borrowing, so less money is being invested in economic projects. And this was something fairly small that I think had a really broad impact on their economy as it went forward. And this is something that the Greeks paid a lot of attention to. So, the Greeks are right next door. Throughout history, I guess you don't really think about how each, consecutive or subsequent civilization that spurs up next to another or after another, they're going through the texts and what's been written by these guys in the past, and they're taking an inventory of what worked, what didn't, what they can learn from it. And that's essentially what the Greeks did. So Socrates was very strong in his position that debt forgiveness, he said debt forgiveness was a tool of the demagogue. So he didn't want the government taking action in the free market. And within Greece, it was interesting. So, for the most part, they had banks, they had a strong economic system in place. One of the reasons I think they were so successful, they accepted deposits of money. They took the money of seafaring merchants while they were away on travels. They loaned money out to merchants and sailors. And the way a lot of these loans worked specifically was they would invest the money into the voyage. So if you were going to sail off somewhere, if the ship was returned safely, they actually received a return, up to 25%. And if the ship went down, then they didn't get any money. So it was a form of collateral, I guess. I guess it was an incentive to get them to go out to do trade. And because of the ability to lend, a lot of the slaves became rich men eventually. It destroyed this natural hierarchy that was predicated on where you were born, what family you were from. And this was actually something Socrates and Plato were pretty fond of. They liked this hierarchy where the politicians and not the bankers were at the top of the social ladder.
This is pretty interesting, if you don't mind me interjecting
Yeah,
here.
sure.
This is actually kind of like it's the Romans actually should have looked back and listened to Socrates more, because it's kind of funny. Near the end of the Roman history, when the Republic fell and turned into the Empire, this is exactly what happened with them, and why they fell and why they didn't achieve industrialization. It's because, I mean, it's you can't write this stuff. It's literally the case that the last two parties were the demagogues and the what am I looking for? The po There's demagogues and there's another party. That they're basically the same party, and the demagogues wanted to forgive all the debt, and give people grain welfare and free,
Yeah.
and give all the slaves. And people would literally put themselves into slavery because they didn't want to have to pay off this stuff and get, and they wanted to get free grain. And eventually the whole society collapsed. So
Yeah.
they could have looked back to their predecessors in Greece. You actually had probably a lot better of a system for a while. I mean, the Romans definitely surpassed them in terms of architecture and legal precedents that they set for thousands of years, but it didn't really work out for them in the long run.
Yeah, and we always think of conquest as being the fall of civilization, but really it's typically internal. It's economic systems that don't work. It's the collapse of society. It's not these guys getting taken over by their neighbors for the most part. And in Rome specifically, conquest became a means of paying debts, and that's one of the reasons why the empire expanded so quickly, is they essentially said, if you go out there with your army, whatever, whoever you capture, you can sell them into slavery, and whatever goods you steal or acquire from the enemy, those are yours. So the richest men in Rome were typically the generals, and that's how Caesar got so wealthy, was just conquering neighboring states, and he did that with the Celts and the Gauls. And
Exactly.
in his diaries, he was pretty clear that he was just trying to make a dollar.
Yeah. And even the big thinkers then, the philosophers, were looking inward, and even they understood that, they would acknowledge that once Rome ran out of space to conquer, that they would have to turn in on themselves and start devouring themselves. And once they got to the Isle of Man, not the Isle of Man, but the Isle of Britain, and once they got to Germania, north of the Rhine, and they ran into a wall they couldn't surpass or overcome, then they turned back into themselves and started consuming their own wealth that had been cultivated from the European land that they had conquered.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to find a better way of, doing things if your only means of surviving and thriving is taking other people's stuff. You got to
Yeah.
figure out a better system, and it wasn't being done efficiently.
I just remember what word I was thinking. It was the populace versus the demagogue. That's what it
Okay.
was.
Yeah, well, it's still around.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, in South America, South America isn't really something you hear too much about as far as economics, but they used primarily cocoa beans, especially the Aztecs. So they would use cocoa beans, and then sometimes they would use this tightly woven cloth, which is called the quachi. And that cloth would cost about 300 cocoa beans. 20 lengths of this cloth was about as much as a family would live on for a year. You could sell your child for about 600 cocoa beans if you wanted.
Wow, okay.
And they eventually adopted something called hoe money, which was thin copper that had sort of a standard weight and size, which is more similar to the coin money that we see in museums and stuff today. Probably something like the Pirates of the Caribbean Aztec gold that you would see. And I even tying this into Pirates of the Caribbean, the East India Company was actually the first publicly traded company. And that was the first time that they had really opened up companies to becoming joint ventures with shareholders so that they could have these larger scale expeditions. And the East India Company, famously traded all over the world. They were the biggest company on earth for a long time, and a lot of the English Empire's success, I think, is predicated on the East India Company, and a lot of it was driven by the need to secure different shipping and trading routes for that company. So I think that's an interesting shift from where you have an individual business where it's owned by one person. You can really only make so much money. I mean, economies of scale now, you can make a ton just because of the internet. But back then, you were kind of limited to your community and whatever assets you had. But for a large scale trading venture where you're taking hundreds of ships and sailing them around the world, you're going to need a bunch of people involved. And so if everyone gives a little, which is what ICOs are predicated upon today, then you can take on these really large ventures without having a whole lot to put in yourself. So that was a huge measure of success, a huge shift in the way we think about economics. It's something, we still do today. Everyone's goal is to become public for the most part.
If I'm not mistaken, actually, the East India Trading Company and those other ventures, from those crown ventures as they were called, are actually the ancestors of the publicly traded corporations that we know today. The idea of a corporation being a body that's jointly split between the government and the people, private and public come together for a common interest. And that's actually how the United States has its origin. The British Crown would finance these expeditions. And the risk would be it'd be collateral. The collateral risk would basically be your life. I mean, it's such a treacherous voyage across the Atlantic Ocean, especially during that time with that limited technology.
Yeah, and I mean, countries still do that today. So if you go up to some of the Scandinavian countries, and you look at SAS with the which is Scandinavian Airlines, it's mostly owned by Norway, Sweden, and Finland. I'm not sure if Denmark. Denmark probably owns a small share, but it's essentially a state-owned airline company meant to facilitate travel within Scandinavia initially and now more internationally. But states, I think one smart investment for states is facilitating travel and facilitating expansion, exploration, and that's something they've done throughout history. They've been very successful in a lot of ways, and one of those ways, was getting to America. So that'll be our little
That's a
transition
good segue,
into the colonies. So in 1690, that was the first time paper currency had really appeared in the United States, and it was issued by the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And it was to fund military expeditions. This is sort of a recurring theme. It seems like countries are really pushed to, print money of some kind when they need to raise it for military expeditions or wars. And we'll talk about that going forward with greenbacks and stuff like that. But the initial colonial notes were backed by gold and silver. But the people of the colonies soon realized that they couldn't just go and exchange these notes for actual gold and silver. And when that happened, the value fell significantly because people said, essentially, this is bullshit. If I can't turn the money back into gold or silver, how can you honestly say that it's actually worth this much of gold and silver? And so, as time went on, you had Benjamin Franklin in 1739 taking a hard line on counterfeiting. Counterfeiting is another recurring theme. It's something that as currency has evolved, it's become more advanced, but it's always been a problem. Whenever you create an exchange of value, there are going to be people who want to falsify it and use it to their own ends. And this actually became a huge problem in the colonies. So, Benjamin Franklin was tasked with using these nature prints and raised patterns of like actual leaves on the notes. And it was, actually fairly effective to deter counterfeiters because they didn't have the technology to replicate it at least as easily.
Oh yeah, it's definitely a very big concern, especially when they were solidifying the new constitution. It was a huge argument that the Federalists made that you have to have one centralized currency, or at least some of them made. They had to have one centralized currency that was immune to counterfeiting, and actually the providing for the punishment of counterfeiting was specifically mentioned in the constitution. Said the Congress needs to have this power. They recognized that it was a huge problem that could face the it could really threaten the idea of a burgeoning nation trying to unify.
Yeah, and I mean, well, skipping ahead a little bit, in 1865, the Secret Service was actually established specifically to combat counterfeiters. So it was actually not initially meant as a detail to protect the president, as we kind of think of it now. It was specifically a task force to prevent counterfeiting. So that's how big of a problem it's been.
Yeah, their prerogative to protect the president wasn't actually established until I believe it was 1901 with William McKinley when he was assassinated. They realized, okay, we actually need somebody to protect this guy.
Yeah, he's kind of important. People might want
Yeah,
to
we
kill
might want to protect him, yeah.
him. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I mean, in 1775, that was when the Continental Congress issued paper currency to back the Revolutionary War, and that again, they're trying to finance a war, but again, counterfeiting strikes and the value is quickly lost because tons of counterfeit bills are hitting the market. It's increasing the supply, reducing the intrinsic value of the notes. So, it was a problem. And subsequently, the problem was that they were assuming that there was going to be taxation going forward. So a lot of the states weren't a big fan of this. and you can understand why. And this goes into how the central banking systems were started, which I'll go into in a little bit. But essentially, the central banking argument was between state banks and more centralized federal banks. And what the federal government did was put a 10% tax on all state banks so that they couldn't compete with their version. And, it was, didn't take long for all of those to shut down and close their doors. And so in 1811, this is when Thomas Jefferson and Hamilton, had this now infamous argument about national banking, which is, you can see it in Hamilton, the play. But Jefferson essentially said that the Constitution was not going to allow a central bank, and Hamilton said, "Well, it doesn't say you can't have one." You might have more information on that, Will, but
Oh yeah, I'd like to go into that if you want me to.
yeah, go for it.
Yeah, so this is still a controversy today. Not the actual idea of a central bank. I mean, that's still a controversy in libertarian versus conservative and liberal arguments. But is the idea of how far do the powers of the Constitution stretch to imply powers that are not directly stated in the Constitution? This is called the elasticity clause, or the elastic clause, I believe it's called. Where not, it's I think believe the exact words are. All powers not ne necessary and proper for executing the foregoing powers. The Congress shall have all these powers as long as they have something to do, edgewise with these other powers. And one of the powers of the Congress was to collect taxes and collect duties and impose and excises and print its own coin. And people that were arguing for a central bank said that, well, in order for Congress to be able to collect taxes and issue currency, you have to have a central bank. And the people on the other side of the argument were posing that, well, there's no specific clause that says that the Congress can have a federal bank. I mean, we definitely understand the idea of this elastic clause that permits other powers that are not expressly implied or expressly granted. But I think that's kind of one that you might want to include. And I'm sure the founding fathers didn't just forget about it and like, oh man, we forgot to not include that or whatever. Oh, that our bad, right?
Whoops.
Yeah, exactly. So obviously we know who won that argument. And that argument was one that played out, three or four times throughout the course of the United States from when it was a fledgling back in the early days of the Continental Congress up to now, when people are still criticizing this quasi-public multi-person multivariate board of what do they call it? The Board of Federal Reserve Banks. It comprises like 12 different banks, but it's really private, et cetera. I mean, we'll go
They're
into
all
that later.
private, yeah.
Yeah, but go ahead. That's basically the background for that clause.
Yeah, and so in 1816, there was a gold standard essentially put in place in England, and that's something the United States goes on to mirror later. And then 1819, do you want to talk a little bit
Sure, yeah,
about McCulloch?
1819 is probably one of them, probably the second or third most significant Supreme Court case ever to grace our land, and that's McCulloch versus Maryland, which is a Supreme Court decision made in 1819, where the state of Maryland was trying to impede the operation of the Second Bank of the United States, which was the second version of the bank we were talking about earlier, and we'll touch on later as well, by imposing a tax on all the notes of the banks not chartered by Maryland. So it's basically trying to get in the way of the federal government and saying that, hey, there's no implied power or there's no expressly delegated power that says that the federal government's allowed to have a bank that supersedes all banks. And the other side of the argument won. The other side said that, well, not only does the federal government have all these implied powers, but the federal government's supreme in all cases. So even if we don't have these implied powers, doesn't matter, we can still
We can
override
do
you.
whatever we
Exactly. And so
want.
that kind of laid down the precedent that is still used today, that not only, I mean, of course, the supremacy clause is as clear as could be. All federal laws supersede state laws, and that's not controversial at all, in my opinion.
Yeah.
What's controversial is
But
the
then
application
10th
of that.
Amendment, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the application of that combined with things that are implied, how do you can't buttress these implied powers with a supremacy clause when such powers aren't even delegated or granted. So it was a really interesting case, still has ramifications today, but yeah, go ahead and continue on. I think that was just a good step to put in there to
Yeah,
kind of include.
absolutely. So 1861, you're in the middle of the Civil War. Congress authorizes the Department of Treasury to issue these non-interest bearing demand notes. And these are called the greenbacks because of their color. So it's similar to the currency we use today. And actually, all US currency that was issued or has been issued since 1861 still remains valid and redeemable to this day. So, it's probably worth a whole lot more than you'd get for it at the bank, but Good to know. So 1863, Congress formally establishes the national banking system. The Treasury oversees the issuance of banknotes. This was done really to finance the Civil War. There were federal guidelines put into place for chartering and regulating national banks, so they could authorize these banks to issue their na now national currency that's secured by the purchase of US bonds. And then they put that, 10% tax on state banks to discourage competition. And as a result, by 1865, most of the state banks that had received national charters had failed or collapsed, or had not received national charters had failed or collapsed, and the ones that did essentially
That's an
consolidated.
interesting point. So they used taxes to collapse something, huh?
Yeah, taxes were not good for business.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's interesting. That's a new thing. I've never heard of that
Yeah,
before.
it's a strange concept.
Yeah.
So finally, in 1900, the United States decides that they're going to put their own Gold Standard Act into place, which helps lead to the establishment of the central bank and the Federal Reserve. 1913 is when, Federal Reserve Act finally passed. And they start issuing currency in denominations of $500, $1,000, $5,000, even $10,000 at one point, which is interesting. I don't know if you've ever seen one of those, but I think that's a pretty cool collector's item. And in 1946, you had the first credit card actually introduced by someone named John Biggins, and he called it the Charge It Card. So
In charge of
this was.
card, interesting. Was that also like a magnetic strip, or was it just a number like the? Or I guess they didn't have those for a while. They used those things where they try to copy the number on a carbon copy paper, right? Is that the one? Okay.
Yeah, I think so. It's clearly not what we have today, but it was definitely how we got here to, the charge it card. It sounds like a credit card. A lot of people still use that terminology. So we had a big impact on that. Did you want to talk a little bit about FDR?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. So in 1933, via ex Executive Order 6102, Franklin Roosevelt, the president at the time, signed this broad-reaching executive order that banned the hoarding, or sorry, for, would forbid the hoarding of gold coin, gold bullion, and certificates within the United States because of the Great Depression. So it was basically the next step towards removing the intrinsic value associated with the material currency and moving over to an immaterial fiat-based system that we have today. So it was just crazy how this was allowed to pass. I mean, of course we were in really hard times, but just because you have hard time, I mean, there's a really good saying that if the devil's chasing you and you strike down all your laws, what happens when the devil turns around and you try to turn around? All your laws are gone, right? So just because you're pursuing good doesn't mean that you should eradicate all other good to that end, right? I know that's a little philosophical for this, but
No,
he
I mean,
basically banned the people hoarding their own gold. So if you were found hoarding gold, then you not turning into the government, you would be, I think, in prison for 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, during the Great Depression, that was the first time you saw these banking holidays where banks would close up shop, tell you you can't access your money, and they would stop the markets. And that's, to me, that's really scary. I don't know why that isn't a wake-up call to more people. It's something that happened in Greece, very recently, only a couple of years ago. And the fact that you can have a private company with the backing of the government decide that they're not going to give you your money back because they're worried about what you're going to do with it, or they're worried about, the likelihood that they're going to collapse on their own. But I think that was the first time people really saw that the government essentially owns the money in your pocket. They can decide how much of it you can take out. They can freeze it at any time.
Right, and then with the FDIC, they decide how much of it is actually worth reimbursing if the bank were to close up shop and pull a Mt. Gox and run away with all your money.
Yeah, I mean, so I think FDIC is in some ways good just because it gives people the peace of mind to
Oh,
put
yeah, for sure.
their
It's good
money
for our system
somewhere.
now.
Yeah, it's good because, you want money in banks so that you can spur investment, but ideally you do it without the banks entirely. So instead of just sitting on your money under your mattress, you're actually investing it into the economy instead of, letting the bank do it, and that way you're getting interest on it instead of the bank. But, that's a little off the point, but yeah, I mean, I think that's so. Did you want to go into economic systems for a little bit? So after we've talked about the actual means of exchange, talking about how people have decided throughout history that the economy should work, who should get what, how taxation works. There have been all these philosophies throughout time. Some are modern, some have been around for centuries. If you look at, the way we lend and the interest rates and, even the struggle between the proletariat and the bourgeois, this is something that was happening in the times of the Greeks and the times of the Mesopotamians. And these economic systems are what create these levels of inequality because, someone's always going to win. There are always power dynamics. And so, going into these systems, I think, is important. So, did you want to start off with a few that you had on hand?
Sure, yeah. I mean, before we even get into classical economics, the things that is that's attributed to Adam Smith and the idea of a free market or Austrian systems, it's important to kind of lay out the history of what preceded that, because you have to understand what came before in order to understand what came next. I think we could basically start with slavery, because slavery was something that existed for hundreds of thousands of years and didn't really evolve until the Industrial Revolution came on into other kind of mercantilist and capitalist systems. So slavery, of course, being the idea that your name determines your future, your past determines your future, right? So there's no you're completely tied down to your family history. So if you're born into slavery, such as African Americans in the United States during the antebellum era, then you are going to be a slave. That's your legacy.
So where would you put like indentured servitude into that? So I mean, I think that's kind of interesting because it's in between slavery and freedom because it is a choice in a lot of ways. You could pay your fare to get to the United States by agreeing to be an indentured servant for some time going forward. That's kind of almost like what a college loan is today. You're taking, you're taking out this money, but you're essentially their servant, once you
Right.
graduate and once you get
Yeah.
there.
Yeah. Indentured servitude was like slavery light. It was kind of like,
Yeah.
you kind of want to give this credit. He's not a complete slave, but he also is somehow born into the system where he has to work a certain number of years. A lot of times it was 7 years. You work for 7 years and you accumulate this money. So you were being paid wages, but because of either your activities that landed you in this pile of debt, or your legacy and your ancestry, that you were in this kerfuffle, if you want to say, with these other people, where with or with society at large, where you had to work a specific number of years in order to pay off your societal debts. And so people would work usually for terms of 7 years, and instead of getting paid wages, those monies just went directly toward your debt. And after a certain period of time, you were freed. But most of the time, the debts were so big and these periods were so long that it was essentially just putting a different, it's a
Yeah.
rose by any other name, is still a rose, right?
Yeah.
But it took a long time for that to be outlawed in a lot of countries. I think actually that's where the West took command. Slavery still exists
Yeah.
today in large numbers, almost as much as it used to be in prehistory.
Yeah, and I know there were even though very specific laws stating how you had to treat those people, how many meals a day you had to give them in some countries. So,
Oh yeah, it's really
it was built
contradictory, yeah.
into the society very much so, I think. But in some ways, I just like to be a contrarian, but it seems like it almost does give you access to upward mobility in a sense because at least you always have a option. You have one option. You can always just go, if you need to do something, you can always just sell your future labor to someone. Whereas now you got to go to a bank and you got to show them your credit score and you got to show them you have a job. I couldn't just go to someone and say, I'll work for you for a year, if you do such and such for me. The likelihood of that happening isn't really the case. Whereas now, or back then, it was fairly easy to do.
Oh yeah, completely agree. And I don't definitely don't want to fall into that trap of applying modern morals and ethics to past history, because that is a way to kind of erase history, like we're seeing today with these movements to get rid of all these statues and monuments. It's the idea of that our morals today are so far advanced that we can't even consider the ideas of what happened in the past. So
And the
yeah,
irony is, we face all the same problems.
exactly. Just put under different labels, different
Yeah.
monikers, like the social credit system, like exactly what you say. Your past following you, which is of course a good idea. I think your past should follow you, but it should at least be immutable. You should be able
Yeah.
to resolve things that you've done in the past as long as you pay your reasonable dues.
Yeah.
And after that, of course, kind of expanded into mercantilism. Mercantilism was kind of like the middle ground between, well, I don't want to skip feudalism. Feudalism was pretty important because that was also an important stepping stone between slavery and capitalism now. And feudalism was the idea of having vassals and lords. And so you'd have like a lord that would own the land, and then he would kind of lease it out to people to till and labor on. And then that lord would get a percentage. I think it's called just fruits, it was the term. And so the lord would get the vassal would get and the peasants would get a specific amount of it, of the fruit that their labor produced, and the lords would get a percentage of it. Kind of rings a bell for things that we do today, right? You put your money in a bank, and the bank gets a percentage of, you know, the money that they earn off of it. It's a obviously not extremely comparable, but it's likable in a way. And then after feudalism, it went into mercantilism. Mercantilism was kind of like a hybrid between the ancient systems of the past and modern capitalism we have today. It was kind of like state capitalism, kind of like China. I would definitely say that China is kind of a mercantilist country. And so are, you know, countries like the Scandinavian country, like Norway, which has a state fund for its oil. So the reason why Norway is, I think, the top GDP in the world, not GDP, but the top per capita income in the world, it's because they're sitting on top of these huge oil reserves. And the state owns these funds, and that's how they do business. So it's like a quasi-capitalist system where where it's a state capitalist system, kind of like almost like a light version of the USSR, if that makes any
Oh, like
sense.
Saudi Arabia almost. You know, you've
Oh,
got
completely,
the
yeah.
royal family who essentially owns all the industry. The top oil company in Saudi Arabia is, worth over $1 trillion, but we don't consider that a public company. We don't really consider them, to be on the Forbes list, but they're way up there.
Oh yeah, there's on paper there's no material difference between Norway and the United Arab Emirates or Qatar. They're basically the same system. Once you just take a peek on the inside, and you're like, okay, these are vastly different countries. But on the outside, they're really not. And after, of course, mercantilism was kind of the motivation, or at least the undergirding system for the crown corporate charters that we had in England, where the state would get involved in the economy and try to facilitate growth by giving loans predicated on life risk to people that have wanted to explore the new world. And that's how we have our system today. So of course it's easy to criticize these systems, but and even Marx does this. Marx is often held as somebody who just loathed capitalism. He hated it. But no, Marx gave capitalism it's a day in court.
Yeah, the first page of, his prologue, he talks about how capitalism is the best thing we have up until now,
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even not even just now, too, in the future. Until, I mean, clearly, I'm sure he was disheartened to the max when he saw his theory broadly misapplied. When people were like, "Oh no, not Russia! What are you guys doing? You're still feudalists." But yeah, and of course, mercantilism is eventually evolved into capitalism, which we have now, where we have the invisible hand got in the market. And I know my fellow host here, Mark, knows a bit about capitalism. He's a very practiced capitalist.
You could say that. I mean, it's free markets at the end of the day. It's pretty simple. So you have several forms of capitalism. So you've got classical economics, which is, the invisible hand, Adam Smith, free market is all we need to achieve equilibrium, essentially. And then you have Austrian economics that comes up, and so they try and say that the free market can solve most of our problems. And the more we reduce government or eliminate government, the better off we'll be. So they notice that government regulation is creeping up on this classical economic system, and they go a step farther and say, well, we need to actually eliminate as much government as we can, because government seems to stand in contrast to the ability of the markets to operate freely.
Exactly, yeah. Go ahead if you were making another
Yep.
point.
And then, well, I was just going to go quickly into market monetarism, which is very different, which says the government or, the central bank, which, maybe is not necessarily the government, but it's private industry who that doesn't necessarily have the citizens' best interests in mind. And they say the central bank can steer the economy on, a certain path to prosperity if they use metrics like national GDP targeting.
Right, like taking advantage of the capitalist metrics in order to apply kind of more of a controlling hand. So a very much visible hand controlling the economy, yeah.
Exactly. So they're essentially a bunch of statisticians that said we can do it better if we, apply more metrics and more data. The jury's out on that one. I don't think it's great. Essentially, I think what the central banking system did and all of this targeting, is they essentially just move money around the world from one country to the next, so you can create environments where certain countries are more attractive to invest in, because they have higher interest rates or whatever it is, and they can move money, out of the U.S. into China, or out of the U.K. and into the EU. They can, do these things fairly easily, especially because most of these banks are controlled by the same people. So they have sort of a stranglehold on the most important parts of the economy, which are things like interest rates and lending.
Right, and specifically about the families of control, if you want to learn more about that, we actually did a very in-depth episode called QAnon, where we go in and discuss these way more in depth, specifically the controlling of the central banks and how that promulgated throughout history.
Yeah, and at the end of this one, I'll do a little catch up for what's
Awesome.
happened this week. So you have, after this, you've got Keynesian economics, and they think that, policymakers can improve economic stability. They can get full employment, if they have the right policies designed to combat what they call market failures or the inadequacy of the market to address certain things. So, like high unemployment numbers, they attribute this to failure of the market instead of, failure of policy to allow the market to take its natural course. And I think you've seen unemployment rates go down significantly as of late, with a more laissez-faire take on the markets. So, I think you don't want to legislate your way through economic policy. It almost never works within legislation. Everyone's got a different intent. You have so much pork barrel legislation rolled in. You've got backroom deals. You've got lobbyists deciding. And at the end of the day, you look at most of these congressmen who are 70, 80 years old. How much research, how much work is that guy actually doing? Probably none. That guy walks into vote every, a couple times a week, then goes home and sleeps. It's probably about the extent of what they're doing. And on the side, they're meeting with lobbyists and donors so that they can, keep on getting elected. But at the
Yeah,
end of
it'd
the
be
day, the incentives, are all wrong.
nice if they use the same effort and energy that they have for the activism against Trump or even the Republicans against Obama. They were so fierce and fired up. Why don't you just take that energy into the chamber and use it to actually research the things you're voting on?
Well, I mean, it's just people get complacent. It's the same reason why, the people in Mesopotamia who were in debt had a higher output of crops. It's when your face is to the fire, you're going to work a lot harder. And when you're too comfortable and complacent, you're just not going to. So you have to be cognizant of that all the time. And that kind of leads us into behavioral economics, which is the newest economic system brought into view. This was done by two. Well, one was an economist, one was a psychologist. It was let's see, Kahneman, I think. There's a great book put out by Michael Lewis all about how the
Great
pair
author.
came to be. Yeah, what they talked about. And so they both worked at a school in Israel. They talked about how, all of the economic systems we've created are predicated on a basis of logic. So they tell us that every person is perfectly rational, and that's what any economist in a college classroom is going to tell you. They're going to say everything you do is rational. If you go to a pizza place and one slice is $3, but down the street it's only $1.50, you're going to go to the other place unless, there's a utility of the taste that's higher. But what they don't do is they don't tie in, I guess, the sort of dichotomy between the left and right brain. So there is, we do use logic to make a lot of our decisions, but we also use emotion. So they talk about the fact that a lot of what we do is not based on logic. And if you know anybody or you know yourself, well, most of the decisions you make aren't all that logical. You don't grab that Pepsi from the fridge because it's going to be great for your cholesterol levels or, prevent diabetes. It's going to increase the risk of both, but you do it anyway because that's how you feel. And so they talk about how important that is when people are making decisions that affect the economy. And so you have to take sociology and psychology into consideration when you're thinking about anything. And this has sprouted off a lot of offshoots within that discipline as to, on one hand, you have companies trying to figure out how do we take advantage of this. And companies like Facebook have. That's why you have these notifications that, hit the God, that's a hard word. The dopamine producing regions in your brain that give you essentially a little hit of what you get when you do cocaine or Adderall or even smoke weed. So you get this little feeling of satisfaction. Dopamine is your reward center, so it makes you feel good about yourself. It makes you feel confident. And so companies have taken advantage of that, or they've even looked into how product placement affects consumer behavior. So when I worked at Abercrombie, they had store layouts, to the centimeter of how every single product would be presented every, day of the week, how many should be stacked. It was all about, what the appearance was going to be the first time you stepped into the room, what you were going to be drawn to, where they were going to make the most money based on that. So there's a lot of science that goes into this stuff, and
Interesting.
it's important to realize, I think, how much it plays a role in our lives.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, touching on that, the Abercrombie example, I've read recently or watched this YouTube video. Actually, I don't want to credit myself for reading something that I actually watched on YouTube. I tend to do that a lot. But Apple actually, I was always wondering why Apple always disables the comment sections in its YouTube videos and never allows comments on its Facebook pages or anything like that. And it has to do with the behavioral side of public relations, or at least the publicity part of Apple's marketing strategy. And that is that if you allow people to openly discuss or even just troll you online, that people will see that, and instead of looking at what you proclaim to be the essence of your products, they'll take in somebody else's, like, oh, well, the consumer knows more, right? The customer's always right, so we'll go look at what the customer says. And so Apple doesn't even give that chance, and that could be an attribution to their success because they don't allow other people to make the decisions that informed by their own illogical behavior, fundamentally illogical
Oh,
behavior.
sure.
Yeah, so I
And
mean,
I mean,
definitely makes
mass
sense.
psychology is huge as well. We're automatically attracted to things that everyone else is doing. It's more comfortable. We think someone else has validated it. So when all of your friends are on Snapchat, the network effects are super high because you want to be where everyone else is. And Snapchat might not be the best, maybe you like Instagram stories better, but if all of your friends are in one place, that's where you're going to go. So they, I think, have really harnessed, and especially in elections, they've found ways to use this, to weaponize this, to convince people to act in certain ways, believe certain things, because people don't want to be socially ostracized. So it's more convenient just to move with the crowd than it is to push back up against a current. And that's, they've taken advantage of that to convince people to act certain ways, to do certain things, to vote a certain way. And that's why you had this consensus cracking that people have talked about Google using, where they take, armies of bots that all seem to have the same opinion, to essentially attack people in these groups that feel like, it makes a single person feel like they're up against massive opposition, that their opinions are so far out of the mainstream that they can't even be publicly disclosed. And it's really effective for shutting people up because people respond to shame and criticism. It's how we evolve, it's how we learn what is
Oh yeah,
okay, what's
we
acceptable.
saw an example of that with Chance the Rapper. I'm sure you saw his tweet where he says black people don't have to be Democrats, and then he just got lambasted and roasted over the coals by everybody. And then he had to issue a retraction. Well, he didn't have to, but he felt like he had to. He went out and issued a retraction, said, "I'm so sorry. Obviously, not all black people have to be Democrat, but in this the era, they kind of have to be." And so, just like you're saying, once you face that wall, or even another example, did you see that? I think I actually mentioned it to you. That girl wearing the dress, the prom dress. Online, she wore this traditional Chinese dress, and this guy came out, this random guy on Twitter came out and said, "My culture is not your goddamn prom dress." And he got 160,000 likes, and so now you have over 100,000 people bullying this one girl, even though they don't know her, they've never met her. So just adducing your point or crediting your
It's
point
all
there.
virtue signaling, it's that's really all it is. So it's something I think you have to be aware of. Don't do anything just because everyone else is doing it, because most of the time no one has any idea what they're doing. And I just had well, I don't know if I'll talk about that on air because they might listen to this podcast. But there are a lot of people within industries where you would, and within, inside positions, where you think these people really should know what they're doing. You know, there was we had a speaker at our college graduation. She ran a multi-billion-dollar tech company, and she said she doesn't know how to use a computer. I was like, what? You know, and that's you start to realize how little everyone else knows about, you know, what's going on. Everyone's just kind of following the leader, and that's why the economic crisis of 2008 happened. You know, any sane person looking at the indicators could tell that something was wrong, but no one wanted to believe it because you go to these conferences and everyone was making so much money and everything seemed great. No one wanted to talk about what was actually happening, and anyone who did was immediately ostracized and pushed out because they didn't want to hear it. They would rather delude themselves with this more convenient truth than, you know, get a heads up as to what was actually going on.
Yep, exactly. Did you want to get into the latest Q drops?
Yeah, so I was going to first, I just wanted to go into some of the takeaways. I mean, first, so tying this back to crypto, you know, governments have always had a hard time fighting counterfeits. And interestingly enough, that's something crypto does very well. It's really hard to counterfeit a cryptocurrency. You really can't. I mean, you can do a split, which is kind of like copy pasting the code and, you know, doing your own thing, but you're not actually taking someone else's property in that sense. And so cryptos and blockchain are a great way to do this because you have a public ledger. Everyone knows who owns what.
Well, if you have a billion years, you can fake it if you want.
Yeah, exactly. Quantum computing, maybe.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, that it offers a great remedy to that. Throughout history, it seems like what is being exchanged does not really matter. It's more just the perceived value or the fact that, you know, other people will accept it. That's one reason I think gold has done so well as the standard means of exchange. And I think it's interesting to also tie gold back to the Egyptians even. So Egyptians were some of the first people to really showcase gold, to put it on, put it on display for people. I believe they thought it would give them immortality, or at least extend their lives drastically. I know people have talked about white gold maybe doing that. But that utility was really important, especially bronze. I think bronze is a great example because they were using bronze to make weapons, you know, weapons, armor, shields. So it had a real practical value when you were exchanging it. And the practical value of cryptos is the ability to send money anywhere in the world essentially for free. I think the biggest transaction, it was hundreds of millions of dollars worth of, I forget what currency they use. I think it was Litecoin. And they were able to send that for $5. You know, anywhere else you go to try to send an amount that high, you're going to face massive fees. If you're taking 3% on PayPal, you know, that could be $3 million. So it does that, you know, incredibly well. I think, you know, debtors' prisons, I think, changed incentives a lot. So they gave people the option to restart with a clean record. They could serve their time. And they also had access to credit in a way that was somewhat different from how it is now. So now you have to have something as collateral that is not your life or your labor. Whereas then all you needed was a body, and all of a sudden you had access to capital or lending of some sort because you could promise to pay them back in other ways. It's not something we can do now. And I think the lending system in this country is, you know, especially messed up. And it forces people to work really hard for things that they don't even necessarily want. And I think that can be sort of dangerous. But at the same time, you know, creating these larger companies with diversified ownership gave people the ability to collaborate on a much bigger scale. And I think I'm hoping that crypto does that for a lot of different ventures that private companies haven't been ambitious enough to tackle. So things like SpaceX, where it's really hard to get private investors to put money behind it because you have to be, one, really smart to make the business model work because it's not cheap. And two, you have to do it incredibly efficiently and without fail time and time again, which is, you know, another very difficult part of rocketry. So people have strayed away national governments have strayed away from space travel just because once you've been to the moon, the next, big rallying cry to increase the patriotism of the citizens in your country is going to be something like Mars, and that's just an investment no one has really been willing to make, no one country, because it's not politically convenient for leaders that are looking to get elected. And if you look at the space programs throughout history of different leaders, they were typically put into place when someone was facing a rough election year. So this happened with Nixon. He put a lot of time and energy into the space program before one of his elections, and then afterwards, really didn't seem to give it much thought because it sounds good. You want people to get behind it. It's exciting for people, but it's diminishing returns politically speaking.
Yeah, imagine if we had taken the money invested in the drug war that he started and put it into the space program.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and if we had put all the money from Afghanistan and just all the wars in general. I mean, if you look at, so people love to point to the northern, the Scandinavian countries as these pinnacles of society. Well, one of the reasons why they're so rich is because they stayed out of the First and Second World Wars. So they never put any money into those massive wars. And of course, you're going to have people that are better off in that case because you didn't have a massive, outflow of money into these ventures. And, it did. World War II got us out of the recession because we became a military industrial powerhouse that we then, sold. We then took all of the hardware that we were creating, sold it to the rest of the world. But at that point, you have to create conflict to create demand for all of that hardware. So you create, a terrible incentive system in most cases. And then finally, I wanted to touch on just the total currency in circulation. So, I mean, like I said, there's 1.4 trillion about circulating in bills right now. That number can change as, different balance sheet. So if the Federal Reserve rebalances, that can change. They can always decide to print more money, but that's about what it is. And interestingly, with crypto, so you have, a circulation that's about the same, but on an individual level, I think there are a lot of coins that have been lost for good. So when you talk about currency in the US, if you tear a dollar bill, you can still take it into a bank, and as long as you have more than 50% of it, you can usually get, the full value back.
I didn't know
So
that.
there, yeah, so there isn't actually a lot of cash that's wasted or taken fully off the books in the United States. But with crypto, you have a lot of people who, either lose a hard drive, like a cold wallet gets thrown in the trash. You had a guy who, his wife threw away his desktop with $1 million worth of crypto on it, and he
Oh
was
no.
digging through the trash piles.
Divorce. Excuse me.
Yeah, right. So I think that's happened in a lot of cases because it's much easier to lose and very hard to get back. And so the individual value of any one currency like Bitcoin is somewhat predicated on the total supply, but I think the total supply that's actually in circulation is much less than what we think it is. And what most people are assuming they think it is, because they just don't really understand what it works, how it works, and a lot of it is stuck in seizure vaults. So they'll have the government sell off large quantities at any given time. If you're trading, that's something to keep an eye on. So whenever the government liquidates a lot of coins, the price ends up going down significantly because someone buys them up at a pretty significant discount and then dumps them right away for a profit. And that has also happened with the supposed Mt. Gox trustee in Japan, who's holding on to, who knows how much from Mt. Gox. So you have a lot of money that just isn't really liquid. It's not part of the pool in most of these exchanges. And I think that's really dictating the price is how many people are actually putting their money into the markets. And
Interesting. So, if they were to liquidate that and put it back in the market, would it have a substantial in ramification on the actual, not the supply, but the actual overall value?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean,
Interesting.
you're essentially just flooding the market. So, the more coins there are on the market, the lower the price is going to go because people with lower and lower buy orders are going to keep getting their trades executed. So if he puts in a market order, then yes, absolutely, and most of them do. So when you put in a market order, you say, every single person that has a buy order, I want you to go from highest price to lowest price and sell all my shit. So if Bitcoin's $10,000 and the first guy bids 10,000 and the second guy bids 9,995, so on and so forth until all of them are executed. And at the bottom, if the last guy was 9,000, well, all of a sudden the going rate is 9,000. You've just dropped it by 1,000. And that's purely due. So if you have multiple exchanges, which you do, each operating in their own sort of closed environment, then it'll take a while for the prices on different exchanges to stabilize. So the price on Poloniex will be different than the price on Coinbase. But due to people who want to arbitrage, those prices will equalize because anyone who wants to arbitrage will buy it on Poloniex and then sell it on Coinbase for a profit, and eventually prices will stabilize. So that's how the whole free market
Okay.
solves itself.
Yeah, but I've liked the idea of applying the free market through transaction fees, where the transaction fees are decided by the market at the end of the day, and they settle around a specific amount. So as long as you're willing to pay above a specific transaction fee or at that, then your transaction will be facilitated and executed without any issue at all. So it's kind of like the free market gets put in a little experimental bubble where no government can touch it for the first couple of years, and it's nice that we've been able to observe that, despite the fact that we're living in a system where the free market has kind of gone with the wind.
Well, I mean, here's a really interesting case. So when you look at lending on exchanges, so you want to lend your money out to margin traders who want to trade, 2x because they're super confident it's going to go up 10%, which means they'll make 20% if they trade on a 2x margin. So margin traders are often borrowing money from lenders, but the prices of lending initially, you were talking about like 1% a day, you're down to 0.00015% or something. So when you let the free market take over, a lot of times the price of getting a loan will go down significantly, just because there's so many people trying to lend out their own money instead of letting it just sit there for no reason. But it ends up being better for everyone involved because instead of letting it sit there, I'm making at least some interest on it. And when you compound even that small rate over the course of 365 days, that really adds up. And for the margin traders, they're happy to pay, a very small amount. So, and the exchanges are happy because they're making money on margin calls. So the
Makes sense,
system
yeah.
ends up working.
I'm actually so that's how my cousin works for that department, the stock trading department at US. I mean, that's not what the department's called, but at USAA. And he makes a pretty decent living on the side just doing margin and options trading, so that's pretty cool. But yeah, would you like to get into a QAnon? Yeah.
So I mean, this week has been pretty interesting. So today what dropped was essentially that, Q is saying that in northern Syria, Iran had created this satellite nuclear facility. And the Uranium One deal, which Hillary Clinton had facilitated. Do you want to go a little bit into Uranium One for people briefly?
Oh yeah, I love this scandal. I actually did a video on it. I'll actually have to, on a side note, to start a crypto economy YouTube channel, and maybe for an hour we'll be able to post stuff before it gets demonetized. And go into that. I actually made a very in-depth video, so we'll make sure to link to that after this. But basically, what happened was this Canadian mining financier named Frank Schustra, who was partners with Bill and Hillary Clinton via the Clinton Foundation, decided that he wanted to get into more mining that was international. In order to do that, he started this company that would partner with a South African mining firm. They combined, and then he started making a bunch of donations to the Clinton Foundation, right? Of course, all coincidental. And the Clinton Foundation, of course, at that time, Hillary Clinton was serving as Secretary of State for Barack Obama. Then they merged with this subsidiary of a Russian investing firm called, I believe, ARMZ in Moscow. And after they merged, you require permission in order to sell these vast stockpiles of uranium that the United States has. And of course, at this time, all the investors were making a substantial, we're talking millions, tens of millions of dollars of donations into the Clinton Foundation. And then at some point, this Russian firm that was operated by Kremlin operatives and former KGB operatives decided that they wanted to purchase this new firm that was called, I think the firm that wanted to purchase was called Rosatom. and they wanted to purchase this new firm that had acquired all the stockpile of uranium in the United States, and that required permission from the let's see, Committee of Investments, Committee on Foreign Investments in the United States, of which the State Department is a key member. And after a while, the State Department, alongside this other Committee on Foreign Investments in the United States, approved the acquisition of 20, I think it was 20% of the United States stockpile of uranium. And they approved it with a stipulation that this new company were to remain a public entity in Russia, which of course is really nothing. There's really no solid line between public and private in Russia at this time or at that time. And they agreed to this, and of course the rules changed in Russia, and somehow, bada bing, bada boom, this company became a private entity, and now the operated, of course, by not just Putin operatives, but former KGB operatives and members of this oligarchical establishment in Russia. And so somehow, at this time, of course, all this money is flowing back and forth between Russian operatives and the U.S. in the form of charities. Of course, we all knew what charity that was, right? The Clinton Foundation, if you can call it a charity, more like a money laundering front. And somehow these people in Russia walk away with 20% of our stockpile of uranium, which is a lot more. I mean, you talk about the opportunity cost of losing that uranium is a lot greater than the cost that they paid us. So the money that the United States gains, or at least the Clinton Foundation gains, or whoever had at the end of the day was holding that bag of money, is much less valuable than the loss of that kind of uranium now that's in the hands of Russia. And think of who's partners with Russia, Iran. And that's kind of a good segue into this idea that Iran is kind of like the sister nation of Russia, or at least the daughter of Russia. That's kind of the public front, while Russia is behind the scenes pulling the strings.
Yeah, so I mean, if that is the case, so if some of that material ended up in northern Syria and Iran trying to subvert the nuclear deal was using Syria as a means of skirting the I don't know who goes out and actually checks. Is that the UN or they
It's
have
yeah, it's just like, I think it's a, not a subsidiary, but it's like a group that comprises a bunch of investigators and specialists from a bunch of different countries.
Yeah, so if you were trying to hide from them, they're just going to go to the certain facilities that they know exist within your country. So this would be a good way of doing that. And I think this makes a lot of sense in the context of why we're in Syria at all. So, it's always been sort of strange to me as to why we picked that fight. It doesn't seem to be ours. It seems like a no-win scenario. If you remember when Hillary was campaigning, she was talking about putting up a no-fly zone in Syria. Well, that's literally war with Russia at that
And
point.
that's not even like our opinion either. The
Yeah, no,
generals on
that's
our side and their side were like, yeah, this is going to be a war. That's the only thing
yeah,
we've been able to
you
agree
can't
on.
shoot down Russian jets without, getting into a war. That's just
Didn't
the
Putin,
fact.
oh, this is a side note, didn't Putin actually get, no wait, I'm thinking of House of Cards, never mind.
I mean, they're one and the same these days.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so then Q kind of goes into talking about why there haven't been any big arrests made. So some of the people were lamenting that they had taken a great risk and lost friends or family members because they've been following this and talking about it, and they hadn't had definitive proof yet of what they were talking about. And what Q responds is essentially that in order to prosecute any of these people, you need to clean out the FBI and the DOJ. And that is the case. Those if you're going to prosecute people under, federal law, you need the FBI and you need the DOJ on your side. And that's something, the FBI, he's cleared out all the top rungs. So he's cleared out, just in the FBI, James Comey, Andrew McCabe, James Baker, who is the general counsel, Jim Rybicki, who is the chief of staff and senior counselor. Bill Priestap, which is the head of counterintelligence, he was Strzok's boss. Peter Strzok, of course, Lisa Page. He talks about how they actually have all of the texts finally from those two FBI agents who had said that, of course, the messages were lost; they couldn't be recovered. Well, Q says that they have them and that inside of them. There are revelations about foreign governments trying to essentially collude with governments or, sorry, agencies within the United States to assassinate the president. So if that is the case, that'll be pretty crazy.
So they did. They were able to recover the text.
Yeah,
Oh,
he
I didn't know
said
that.
they
That's
have.
good.
Yeah.
Interesting,
Well,
because there's usually a virus that goes around on all these computers every time Congress issues a subpoena. So it's glad that we got got there ahead of
Yeah,
time.
exactly. So yeah, he focuses on that, and interestingly enough, if you watched his speech, so a lot of what Q talks about is that not everything is going to be talked about on this board. Some of it will be on Twitter. He posts a lot of campaign speeches. And after reading through all of this stuff throughout the week, listening to the speech he gave on Saturday at the rally was really interesting because he talked about a lot of the stuff that Q keeps posting about. He talks about how we need to clean out the DOJ, that it needs to be working for the American people. We know for a fact that the DOJ was definitely not taking on, cases under the Obama administration at the highest levels. It was corrupted. So it would make sense that that's probably still the case in a lot of cases. And a lot of the courts have been very consistent in overturning things that Trump has tried to do that other presidents have had absolutely no problem doing. So it's pretty clearly political bias, and I think he's trying to show people that. So I think in a lot of ways he's baiting people into making these moves that prove that they're not acting in an unbiased manner.
Yep, I agree. And one thing that kind of helps solidify the credibility of the Justice Department, even kind of infuriatingly so, is that Jeff Sessions isn't just the personal hitman of the president right now. I mean, say what you want about him. I think that some of the investigations he's pursuing should be focused on different lights, specifically the Clinton organization, but and even perhaps some activities within the Bush administration. But if you look back in the Obama era, Eric Holder publicly described himself as Obama's wingman. I mean, that's not me making that up. It's a literal quote. And so the idea that it's all just supposed to be this centralized, organized racket where you go after the enemies of the president, I mean, that idea needs to be scrubbed from the history books as quickly as possible.
No, absolutely. And then, so if you just look at what you're seeing on the news now, you're seeing all of this progress with North Korea. We talked about how, Q had said he's already been there. They stopped off, and that's why they had to get fuel in Hawaii, and that Kim Jong-un had to go directly to China to talk to Xi in person, because all of their telecom networks were set up by Google, and that's the reason why Schmidt made his trip down there in, I believe it was 2011, and I think he's made one since, and so he references that, says that's all connected, and I mean when you look at how the situation is unfolding over there, it's almost perfect. It's exactly what you would be expecting to see should they be deciding to reunify. Just a couple minutes ago, I read an article about them being open to putting in McDonald's. Like they want to increase their infrastructure. Kim, in a rare statement, talked about how he was ashamed of his country's infrastructure. And so I think it's pretty reasonable to assume that, they're ready to get into the 21st century. If you think about, he can spin this in a way that actually works for him, which sounds crazy to people, but he has only been in power for 6 years. He can pretty easily say that he was just raised to be put into this position. He really didn't have a choice in the matter. And he can talk about how he wanted to bring his people into the 21st century and let them indulge in the pleasantries of the West. And so I think he can do this in a way that allows him to remain a hero to his people, and I think that's what they're trying to do. I think there's going to be massive foreign investment in North Korea as soon as things open up. They're going to sign the peace treaty. I think we're going to start to see sanctions disappear. We stopped the training exercises that had really pissed them off forever. If you look at, why they even said they were developing their nuclear program, they always pointed to our training exercises that are right on their border, and they always said, if you stop those, then we are going to consider stopping our nuclear program, but until then, we're going to feel like we're constantly under threat. And these were the joint US-South Korean exercises where they essentially practice invading North Korea every year,
they take place every year. It's like it's like, all right, come on, guys.
And
But
at the end of the day, it's just kind of a waste of money. They're blowing tons of
yeah,
money on
and
that
I don't want to
stuff.
give undue credit before it actually happens. They haven't reunified, obviously, but this is a major step that has not occurred before. And actually, you brought up a point that I hadn't really considered before this podcast, and that's the idea of that, Kim Jong-un has been in power for 6 years, like you say. It's not like as soon as he gets in power, he can institute all these reforms immediately.
Yeah.
Because if he were to say, oh my gosh, you guys are all living under tyranny, there would be either everybody would commit like mass suicide or there'd be mass revolts.
You know, yeah, it'd be off with his head. You know, exactly, he's not going to. Yeah, so he's. And if what Q is saying about the CIA and whoever else actually, you know, being behind some of North Korea, which is also fully possible, you know, it's not like the CIA has had no role in foreign governments, you know, in the past.
What?
It makes sense that you would want to have a boogeyman somewhere all the time to support massive investments in military, things like that. And, you know, the CIA, what they are, is essentially a giant slush fund. So they are not bound by any laws, by any government. They can do whatever the hell they want. But the problem they have typically is funding. So they can't, you know, they only get so much money from Congress. But what they can do is take that money, invest it into enterprises like drug smuggling, or, you know, whatever illegal activity that you can imagine. If they profiteer off of it, then they can reinvest that money into whatever else they want to do. And so I think that's, you know, they've essentially become their own cartel in a lot of ways. And this has been proven time and time again with, you know, Iran-Contra. And I mean, this is out in the open for the most part. And so it makes sense that they would be acting kind of like a cartel in some parts of the country. And this is a large organization, but, you know, fully possible. Then that's what he seems to insinuate.
Let's not forget that, you know, I don't want to give undue credit to Kim Jong-un and pretend like he's some benevolent, you know, god or something like that. But let's not forget that the United States conflict with the ideological conflict with the Soviet Union is a reason, the sole reason that the Korean Peninsula is split, is bifurcated between these two countries. Because we wanted, I mean, I do think that we were on the right side there. I think that we were trying to advocate for free market capitalism. We clearly were. We did, I mean, it is kind of like a socialist or communist dream of propaganda, the fact that we went in and kind of rained down pamphlets on South Korea and said that this is what you can have. You don't have to, this is what you can have if you go to South Korea. It's kind of like a communist, you know, wet dream there. That's like, oh, look at this Western power is trying to imperialize us. But at the end of the day, we're, you know, our conflict with them, whether regardless of whether it was right or wrong, and I do believe it was right, we are the reason that it's split between them, between the two different opposing states. So as quickly as possible, we'd like to get that back together. And it seems like even if Trump had nothing to do with it, which of course I don't believe, I think Trump was very instrumental in this. I think that's obvious. But even if he wasn't, I think there's a Nobel Prize in order, no matter how inconsequential those awards are.
And I think, when you look all the way back into the Q post, he lists a very specific timeline. He talks about the order in which he's going to go through and tackle these obstacles. And so far, it's been pretty spot on. So he said that immediately after North Korea, they would go to Iran. Well, literally the minute that happened, now we're talking about Iran. And that was as a result of Netanyahu. And you know, we can tell Netanyahu when to start talking about things. I'm sure this was
planned. I love that picture of him. Iran lied. Did you see that?
No.
It was his presentation, and he's just standing there smiling with a smirk, like a typical Netanyahu smirk, and there's this giant screen behind him with Iran lied in big black letters.
He's been wanting to go after Iran forever. I mean, he's... Yeah,
that's,
but
that's,
I mean,
also a word of caution. We gotta also recognize that. Like, this, we can't really let them warmonger. But I do think he's got a good point. I mean, clearly they're lying about their nuclear systems. I mean, this deal is so perfectly orchestrated for them on their behalf that, you know, we kind of need to renegotiate this.
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, I think the deal, you know, any deal that can prevent you from going to war, and, you know, the war that we would have had with Iran should something have happened, I mean, that would make Afghanistan look like kind of a cakewalk, I think, and that's the worry. But at the same time, you know, the whole reason they have the missile designs is because the CIA literally gave them to them as part of an operation to supposedly throw them off track, but they ended up giving them more information than they had had previously. And so when you look at all of these things back to back, it just seems too dumb to be, you know, the actual motive. It seems like, I don't think people at the highest levels are that incompetent. I think we just have incomplete information. And I think that goes for most things. The amount that goes on behind the scenes, there's, you know, a massive amount. And I think, to me, what Q is sort of peeling back the curtain so people can see, why these things are actually happening. We just get told the end result. We don't get to really see what bargaining has to be in place to get there, what everyone wants, how politics works at the highest levels of global governance, because at the end of the day, it's just interpersonal relations, just people trying to, live amongst each other and trying to get things from each other. And I think the fact that Trump has been a very straight talker has been really good for us, especially in countries like Saudi Arabia. There are a lot of reforms taking place. They're going against a lot of the orthodoxy, I think, that has caused so many problems. He's calling them out for certain hypocrisies. So, I think in that way, things are looking up.
Yeah, and I agree. And it's kind of hard. I definitely sympathize, even empathize with the left and the critics of the president when they're trying to, and his detractors when they're trying to lambaste him for every single thing that he does. Because if I look in the mirror and have to acknowledge that I definitely did a lot of that during the Obama era. And you have to like sit back and ask objectively, is the state of the world better or worse after this person or right now? Is it better or worse than it was a year ago? With Obama, I don't think it was necessarily worse. I can't really make a good case in all honesty that that's that much better. I really don't think it's that much better than it was when he started. I'm sure. I mean, of course, the global economy is better, but I don't attribute that to him. But right now, it seems like the state of the world is, objectively is better than it was 2 years ago. I mean, that's like by any factor
Beyond
you can
our
imagine.
wildest
Yeah, like
imagination,
look at
too.
Korea. This idea of Korea, this guy, this dotard, as he called Trump, basically this rocket man stepping over the DMZ for the first time, like in his life, essentially,
And
and
you have,
hugging him.
he's
Yeah.
got a great relation with Xi Jinping.
Yeah.
I mean, really, probably the world leader he has the worst relationship with is definitely Putin, and that's not even of his own volition, so
Yeah.
it's pretty impressive, I
That's
think,
all the
what he's
ruse, though.
done.
Be careful. That's all a ruse. He's just trying to
Yeah.
hide his connections, you know?
You're right. They're best friends. They
Yeah.
talk every night before they go to sleep.
Of course.
Well, I think there's one last thing I wanted to say. So it was interesting. I was listening to a podcast yesterday, and it was the Rubin Report. And on it, he had Sebastian Gorka, who was one of the national security advisors to Trump within his administration. And he specifically mentioned the hunt for Red October, which is a recurring theme in a lot of Q's posts. He talks a lot about the hunt for Red October, and he uses it as sort of a code word to let his followers know. And he said that people should listen for references in the media and things like that. And I thought that was notable, at least, because it's kind of an obscure reference to be made by a random cabinet member
Interesting.
of his team.
Yeah,
So
I like Sebastian Gorka, a very intelligent guy, not
yeah,
willing to be abrasive
very
when it
bright.
counts.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed that. So if you guys are looking for something to listen to, that's a great one. And with that, I think, we just wanted to close with Will finished putting out the Atlas Digest app. So that's on the iOS App Store. So if you just look up Atlas Digest, it'll be up there. And so all the news stories we publish will be pushed to that platform. We're just finishing editing one that we're going to be putting out today, the Weekly Digest. We have Will put together an iMessage stickers app as well. So if you want to send cryptocurrency stickers to your friends, you can download that for free. Probably easiest way to find that is just to find the Atlas Digest app and then go to our little company profile, click that. And we have one for America emojis as well that we actually did for Peggy Grandy, who was one of
Yeah,
our past guests.
very, very cool that you were able to acquire whatever
Yeah, I
it's called,
think
yeah.
yeah, she's got a lot of really high level people around her. I
Yeah, and
think Rick
then
Perry and like a bunch of guys, and she's talked about the people who have downloaded that app, and it's pretty awesome.
that's awesome, yeah. And then one more thing, we actually also did Enrique, our other very important person in this company, did a basically reformed and remapped all the websites for the company. So if you go to cryptoeconomy.world, the new interactive website's up there, and then also atlasapp.co for our next upcoming app, Atlas. Go ahead and check those out and read through that for your enjoyment.
And we'll have those in the description on the link. And I also wanted to close with we've had a few people send us messages through Anchor. We really appreciated those. We thought they were pretty pretty fun, somewhere interesting, somewhere inquisitive. I just went through and responded to all of those. I hadn't really checked up on it, but I appreciate you guys being engaged and reaching out, and we're always happy to talk to you. We've talked to some really interesting people who've joined our Telegram group. I think we're gonna have one on later this week, probably. So feel free to reach out on there. And we'll have Eddie Zillow on Wednesday. He took his bat mitzvah money and made millions in Bitcoin. So
The new
we'll talk
American
to him.
dream.
Yeah, it really is, right?
And one last note on the messages thing. If you guys have any, I mean, we appreciate you listening. If you have any input or feedback, or if you have any suggestions for future shows, don't feel free to hesitate. Don't hesitate to contact us about that, and let us know what your opinions are.
We have our final pitch event on Thursday in front of, Tim Ferriss and Bob Metcalf and a few other people. And we'll be launching the Atlas app pretty soon after that. We'll have the demo done by then, probably beta test, and then launch it soon after. So we're excited to finally get that out. And then we'll probably move on to the miners. And we'll just keep the ball rolling, get stuff out for you guys.
Very awesome. Thanks for listening, guys.
Yep. Thanks, guys. We'll see you next time.